Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. And what a Monday we had yesterday as we taped this on a Tuesday afternoon. It's shaping up to be some dogs barking outright, but 20-1 favorites went in the NBA, Major League Baseball, and hockey. Just a remarkable run. I wrote a newser that's on ESPN.com's chalk section. Go check it out. Just the historic nature of it. I believe DraftKings said it was the third most payouts they've had in terms of dollars since they've been around. And Jimmy Vaccaro, the legend, almost 40 years of bookmaking in Las Vegas, said he doesn't really remember seeing something like that. 20-1. He had some 15-5s by favorites, but nothing like 20-1. And just books took a pounding. William Hill, almost $1 million alone in Nevada, let alone the 12 states they have over 150 properties in. So just crazy. And then that was Sunday baseball winners did as well. So just remarkable. Obviously, we'll see what happens today on Tuesday with the Bucks trailing. And we'll get into all that with Preston Johnson. You know him from Daily Wager. You know him from ESPN.com. You know him from this podcast as well. And then Wes Reynolds is going to join us for some golf. I'm giving Lou and Matthew Holt the week off. So no UFC on this pod, but still plenty of content as sports are ratcheting up. We have NFL around the corner, getting a lot of emails from my pick'em leagues and fantasy. So a lot to get through. We'll start with Preston doing a pseudo preview because this is day two of the NBA postseason, but still plenty of hoops to dissect. And before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everyone with the much anticipated start of the 2020 football season just around the corner, make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Time now to welcome in a friend of the program and a delayed start to our NBA playoff preview. Preston, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you.
Shame on me for not orchestrating this advance, but shame on the NBA. You know, come on. We don't work weekends, right? No one works. No, I'm just kidding. I just, you know, it was just a lot of things going on, and I was planning on doing something maybe for the second round or something. Then one day of you know, exciting playoff action, it's like, all right, we need to do this. But I will say this: I will not ask you about Fernando Tatis Jr. and sit and taking a 3-0 pitch because everyone seems to be talking about that today. We don't have to.
That's good. Let's skip it.
So we did some we taped some segments, and we also did some content for ESPN.com's chalk section in terms of like our favorite plays. And we've talked a lot throughout this resumption and even before that in terms of the potential value with this unique playoff format in the bubble and the neutral court. And you were first ahead of it. I wrote a piece about it that the Bucks were just way too big of favorites. That number's come down. It was like, I believe, $1.75 to win the East entering the postseason, down from -230. But it sounds like, you know, this Bucks team's is kind of out of sorts. What do you make of this start? And as we're watching, they're down, you know, down in the second half here in game one.
Right. And as we're recording here, I think they're down 8 to the Magic still mid third quarter. So it's interesting. I think, you know, we kind of talked about needing to overreact or to adjust more aggressively when the restart did happen, just to how teams were playing. I did that with the Lakers. I've also done that with the Bucks. I know they say or claim or want to say that they can just flip a switch, but I mean, it's over 4 months that these teams haven't played and now they're going back at it. You can't just, if you look bad for 8 games, all of a sudden look great now against even a team like Orlando Magic, who were 14-point dogs before this tipped off. So they have looked out of sorts, and I don't want, it's one game, obviously, too. They might figure it out. They deserve to be the favorite. Granted, we talked about how probably not as big of a favorite as they were, but with Gordon Hayward's injury, Ben Simmons' injury, I mean, the East is getting easier for them if they can get past Orlando. But I will say this, I feel like to some extent, you know, Budenholzer's kind of been solved. Now that's like the drastic way of saying the Bucks aren't going to win. They still can, but Toronto kind of laid out the blueprint on how to, you know, wall off Giannis and make everyone else beat him. And just even when Budenholzer was in Atlanta and had those teams that would win 60 plus games in the regular season, they couldn't even win a playoff game against the Cavs. And now, you know, here with the Bucks, they're struggling. And I saw last year, you know, up 2-0 as soon as Toronto made adjustments. Budenholzer just doesn't make adjustments. He just sticks to the plan. This is what has gotten us here. And in the playoffs, it's all about making those adjustments and countering what the other team or your opposing coach or personnel are doing. And if they're not making adjustments, man, like, they definitely are beatable. And the Magic, again, now up 9. I think for sure worth paying attention to. And you know, I'm similarly worried on the Lakers side in the West as well.
Yeah, we'll get to the Lakers in a moment, but I just want to follow up on something that you said that was really interesting. And I quoted you for my column, and I just want to get this for our audiences. With the adjustment to the no longer the home court format, you know, where the Bucks would be the one seed throughout, and then the rest, you like that change to the format forced the biggest adjustment in your model.
It did, yeah. And you know, they had the best record in the NBA, or they were likely to finish with it, so they would have had home court advantage through the entirety of the playoffs, through the NBA finals, which is pretty massive. And then you know, one thing I thought was worthwhile and interesting was that they were just kind of the most rested team anyways. At that point, Giannis, you know, leads the team with 30.9 minutes played per game, and they were spacing it out. And Budenholzer did do a great job of that, of just their depth and resting guys and just not having to go crazy during the games and playing these 40-something minute games just to get wins. They were winning anyway. So they had an advantage as far as rest is concerned. Then everyone got over 4 months off to rest. So it was one of those things where home court gone, rest gone, which probably would have benefited them. And then Ben Simmons being back for Philadelphia increased Philadelphia's chances some. But I think the Bucks, the drop-off was either 15.1% or 17.1%. I don't remember off the top of my head anymore. But it was in that range where they went from, you know, winning the title X amount of times to 15 to 17% lower. It was wild to see, but a lot of it just had to do with that. And then now they're not playing very well. They didn't really in the restart, and it'll be interesting to see how this really plays out.
Yeah, we both like the Sixers. Obviously, that has taken a bit of a hit with Simmons now out for the postseason. I liked some of the things they did, and you know, just in terms of the game-to-game basis, I love the Celtics in game two. I may even hammer the money line even more. I hated what I saw at the end of game one, and I know you're a modeler and you don't want to pay attention to the narratives, but I just feel like Joel Embiid is who they need to go through to win, and I just don't think stamina-wise, and I mean, I know he takes threes, but at two-pointers, you could just sustain it for four quarters and beat the Celtics team. So I think at just some point, the Sixers are kind of going to fold. And I just really like the Celtics in game two.
Well, the Celtics didn't even – I mean, that was – it's modeling or not, a narrative or not. It was just the way that the Celtics game planned and adjusted, especially second half. You know, they wouldn't even let Embiid get the ball. And Philadelphia was trying to force feed him. They were trying to give him the ball, and they would, like, semi-double on the entry pass. And then Philly would be like, oh, well, I got to swing it to the open guy. And then Boston would rotate back. Or if they finally did get it into Embiid, they would instantly double for real. And then they had, I think, the last three times he touched the ball in the post, he turned it over. And then in the fourth quarter, it didn't seem like he even got the ball a single time in the post. And everyone's going to talk about that and blame Brown. But look at how Boston defended that. It was absolutely incredible. They had obviously planned it perfectly. And then when you're stuck with, oh, we couldn't get the ball to Embiid in the post, oh, now there's only 8 seconds left on the shot clock, Alec Burks, do your thing. Like, he's the guy off the bench that was trying to drive and do hurry and run pick and roll. I mean, it was just great defense from Boston. At the same time, the Sixers were still up 7 with like 9 minutes left in the fourth quarter and almost won the game. You know, they were in it to some degree. So it's interesting. Yeah, I think it has to be Embiid, but they have to do a better job of finding a way to get him the ball in that position, because they just absolutely, you know, fell off the face of the earth in that second half, and he hardly had any touches.
Yeah, they were down 3 with 59 seconds to go, and after they hit a 3 to make it from 6-3, and then, you know, didn't make another shot. They made one free throw in that final 59 seconds. So, and that goes to what I'm sure everyone's heard, is the 4-0 in the NBA ATS, 20-1 did favorites go on Monday across the three major U.S. team sports. But, yeah, so the Celtics were having Marcus Smart defend Embiid in the high pick and roll. And then if he rolled the hoop, they switched with Tice coming over. And it was just, like, perfectly choreographed, because they just didn't have to worry about really anyone driving like a Simmons out there. So I just think the Celtics, obviously I liked them to begin with. I thought -1.5 games, -140 was a great play. Basically, Celtics have to win the series in six games or less. And
I think the Sixers just kind of defeated, right? I don't think they trust Brown. I think the Celtics are on the up and up, if you will. So that's where I'm looking at. But in terms of the other series on Monday, because we're looking ahead to game twos, Mavericks Clippers, obviously a whirlwind with Porzingis getting thrown out. It was a high scoring first half. Somehow the game stays under. The final shot by Tim Hardaway Jr. dictated the side and total with just a few seconds left. So point spread drama there. In terms of the Clippers, showed some vulnerability, but it was really just the Mavs hitting like ridiculous shots.
So they were on fire from three in that first half, but then they cooled off the other way in the second half, like to the degree that, I mean, they only scored 13 in that third quarter. KP gets ejected, which that was all bogus and insane anyway. And I thought the whistle was fairly friendly to the Clippers the entire time because that first tech he got was a clean block. There were a few other blocks that were called fouls. It was really strange, to be honest. And the Clippers did look vulnerable, but I think the main reason being that when they brought in their second unit, Montrezl Harrell hadn't played in 5+ months. He wasn't even playing in the restart. This was his first showing. I don't remember what his plus minus ended up being at, but like when there was that run where Mavs were down 16 early, then they were up 14. This is all like between the mid first quarter to the mid second quarter. Then they brought Zubats back in, put Harrell on the bench, and you know the Clippers actually tied the game within like 5 minutes. So Harrell was a disaster. He looked completely lost. The Mavs ate him up. We'll see if that's going to be a thing going forward. It probably is just one of those first game back, like you got to get some minutes, get some reps, but that might take some time. But when it's all said and done, I still think the Clippers deserve to be the ultimate favorite. You saw they were able to, I mean, they forced Luka, what, 10 or 11 turnovers in that game, despite him scoring 42, I think, and setting the record in a debut for a playoff game. They did their best they could, and you know, eventually the Mavs stopped shooting 50% from three, and that's ultimately why the Clippers won, other than the KP injury, or ejection, I should say.
In terms of game two, you've just said that the Clippers should be the favorite in your eyes to win it all. I agree. I like him plus 170 before the playoffs. I just felt more comfortable with the Western Conference plus 170 than to win it all, whatever, plus 325. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, like, game two and moving forward in the series and coaching adjustments and all that, do you think – like, I felt there was a little high at 6.5 last night. I mean, I felt there's been attacks on these favorites in general. But what's your kind of gut tell you or your – because remember, we have no zigzag theory. There's no travel. Like, your overall sort of, anticipation of what you might do in game two, the over. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of options there.
So I had three bets in that game last night. I bet the first half over, which was no sweat, right? 135 at halftime. I also had the full game over 228.5, landed 228 for those that don't know off the top of your head. And Beverly missed two free throws down the stretch back to back. Or any of those Mavs threes go in, you know, that's in. But I also had bet the Mavs at +7. Once it got there, I thought that was too extreme. And, you know, on a neutral court, I know now there's some say, and based on the data we have so far in the restart, that home court still kind of like home court, even though they're playing on a neutral court where those home teams are shooting better, everything going on there. So the ultimate thing for me was I think it might be noise, might be a smaller sample. I don't think that because they're playing with their logo on the court and there's a little more PA noise going through when the other team's shooting or something like that, that's going to swing this a few points to a point spread. It just shouldn't be the case. So I ended up taking Mavs at 7, and the ultimate like nut low option for me was it landing 228-8, which is exactly what happened. But I did get off some of the Mavs side when KP got ejected live. The Clippers were only like -3.5. So I turned out okay there. Game two, I think you just have to like let it go, and the number has come down. It's kind of like that zigzag, like you mentioned, right? It's only 5.5, 6. 1-6 I see on the screen right now, 2 sixes, mostly 5.5s though. So if that's the case, it looks like Caesars is actually 6, but most places are 5.5. So it's similar with, despite the Gordon Hayward injury, you know, this Sixers line's down to 4.5 against the Celtics anyway. Like the zigzag is, you know, the bounce back. There's generally something to that, but you're, again, there's no home away. There's less travel. Maybe it isn't a thing. It's one of those where I'm not going to try to guess. I think this is closer to where the fair line should be, which is why I bet +7. But if it's 5.5, you know, it's a stay away.
Well said. I can't imagine 7 ever again in the series. I don't know. I could be wrong. Wouldn't be the first time.
Down 3-0, they might just one of those. Usually the team down 3-0 gets a big, like, okay, they're just super flat, the line's right, inflated. So that'd probably be the only other chance I think we see the 7.
What about the Utah series? Conley still probably not going to be back because of the quarantine and all that.
So that one, I mean, so I like Denver prior anyways. We wrote about that one for our Chalk article. But for me, what I thought was incredible was the fact that Donovan Mitchell set a franchise record scoring 51 in the playoffs. 57 ultimately in the end, but the 51 he needed in regulation just to get into overtime, and then you lose anyway. Like, that has to be so demoralizing. And I know the Nuggets also shot pretty well from three. They don't shoot a ton of threes, though. I mean, they probably hit three or four above expectation. But you're just never getting Mitchell scoring 51 in regulation again. And that was your one chance to maybe beat the Nuggets without Bogdanović, without Conley, who had to leave the bubble. I just don't think they're deep enough. Denver's the reverse. They're way more deep than Utah. I think Jokic in the Gobert matchup kind of favors Denver anyways, because Gobert has to play all the way out to the three-point line defensively, which he doesn't like to do. And then Jokic can also catch it on the elbow, and he can drive, which he was able to do as well. So everything lines up for me for Denver, and that first game, it just couldn't have been more demoralizing, I think, for Utah. Even if Conley were to come back in game 4 or 5, if it got there, you know, he's not going to be probably the difference maker in this series anyways. So, and Will Barton, by the way, maybe coming back for game 2 for Denver, who hasn't been playing. Gary Harris, also questionable. So they're only going to be getting healthier. Well, you know, Utah's just, I think, yeah, too beat up. Not enough guys, not enough firepower.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, you and I were big on the Jazz going into the season. It's too bad. They just never quite got it together. Conley never found his rhythm. And it is what it is. But so, yeah, I didn't really have a strong opinion. I gave out one play on SportsCenter yesterday, and that was the over in the first half of Mavs and Clippers, unfortunately. I mean, it moved 2 points. In addition, it moved 2 points, too. So that's a good sign across the board. So now we get to the Lakers tonight, and obviously this will post just a couple hours before, but there's a lot of buzz. So let me see if I can get the wording right. The NBA in 2003 went from 5 to 7 games in the first round. So since 2003, when the 1-8 and everything else in the first round went to best of 7, the Lakers are the 4th shortest one seed in terms of series price. So like the Bucks, by example, are 1 to 150, minus 15,000. Okay, they're 150 to 1 favorites. The Lakers are minus $5 and was 450. So, I mean, just at minus $5, they're the 4th shortest since 03 in terms of a one seed. And, you know, it's understandable. Lakers don't have anyone who can guard Dame. I actually kind of like his player prop over just because I think he's going to go off, but I don't necessarily think the Blazers are going to win. But it seems to be when the public's all on a dog like the Blazers, it's usually not a good thing.
That's the way I've been explaining it to people. So all the like sharp guys I know that want to bet this, like trying to be contrarian, like if they see this sexy run from the Blazers, Dame Lillard dropping, you know, 50s, 60s, 40s and back-to-back-to-back games, then, oh, the Lakers were so bad in the bubble. They had the worst offense in the bubble. Their net efficiency was 21 of 22 teams. The only team worse was the Wizards, like C-minus squad that they were just throwing out there to see what the young guys could do. This is a great time to buy low on the Lakers, right? So everyone's saying that, and I get it. But I don't know if it's because I'm like a reverse bias because I'm a Lakers fan, and I just am absolutely scared that they're not going to show here. I think Portland matches up great for them. I think Portland's really good, and obviously Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, you mentioned, no Avery Bradley, no Rajon Rondo. So we're living with Alex Caruso trying to defend these guys. I love the guy. Love him to death, but, I mean, it's Alex Caruso. All right, KCP is going to, as like a bigger wing, going to try to stay with these quicker guards. Danny Green, who's never really been able to stay in front of point guards anyway his whole career, who's already kind of drifted his look this year. You know, he's kind of fallen off anyways, even as a wing defender. I don't think these guys can hang with those two guards. And then on the other side, you know, you have, oh, Anthony Davis, you know, he's going to be a force. And like Nurkic is really, really good at basketball. People forget two years ago, like he was, I just think he's super underrated. He was top 15 in net rating. You know, top 15 in player impact plus minus. He is at least a top 25 guy, and he's come back from this long injury and looked just as productive, especially offensively. He's also now added a three-point shot he's hit pretty regularly. His free throw percentage is way up because he's probably just been shooting for the last year and a half. Then you have Whiteside, another body. I know he's not great, but a body to throw at Anthony Davis. The real edge the Lakers have is LeBron against all the wings, right? No Trevor Ariza now. He opted out. He didn't go to the bubble. So it's Melo, Herzogna, Gary Trent Jr. But you're telling me this Portland team that last year without Nurkic, Whiteside, Melo, Gary Trent Jr., who were leading in the Western Conference Finals against the Warriors last season, every game in the fourth quarter, they ended up losing all four, but they had a chance in all four too. I just don't see how this team doesn't get a couple games. I bet +2.5 at -105 as far as the series games goes for Portland. And I have a little small bet on +500. But I ultimately think, you know, Dame will at least get one probably by himself. And then there's going to be a lot of opportunity for another game just because I think the matchup's so great.
Yeah, I'm right there with you as a Laker fan. And I just think it's, you know, everyone wants to say, like, oh, wait till the playoffs. But the Lakers were trying in some of those games. Now, a couple of them were giant flat spots, like the OKC game. I knew there was going to be limited minutes. I actually thought the Thunder should have been favored, and the Thunder blew them out. But, the Pacers game, like, the starters were playing down the stretch, and T.J. Warren hit a couple three, and they lost. And then even the Denver game, they needed the last minute to beat the Denver, I don't even want to say second unit, but, like, third unit. So,
yeah.
Look, I get it that LeBron probably has another gear, but there are visible deficiencies, which you just mentioned, the ability to guard the guys on the perimeter. And I know people think Dame is maybe the best point guard in the NBA. Now, I'm not ready to go there, but this is not T.J. Warren getting hot, right? It's not even Devin Booker getting hot. Dame's been doing it for a long time. He's a leader. We've talked about it ad nauseum. The guy's a total stud. And with Nurkic back, and if he's sticking threes like he did the play-in game against the Grizz, look out. But I think they're a live dog. I want no part of it, but it is a chic thing to say that the Blazers are going to take him down. And then I do think Lakers should dominate the boards, though. I really do think they're going to, if they go big, especially with McGee and LeBron comes down from the perimeter. So let's move on to – so you say they're a live dog, but it's not obviously enticing enough like some of these other series. Thunder and Rockets are interesting because the Thunder were favored – consensus today, but the Rockets are favored in the series. Now that's all about, you know, it's on a neutral court. That's really weird, right? But it's all about Russell Westbrook returning. These are two teams I kind of wanted to bet on in the first rounds. So I'm a little disappointed they're playing each other. What's your take?
Well, so I mean, Rockets +2, and it was kind of crazy anyways in this game one. They're already a favorite now for later tonight. It's moved this morning.
Wow. Even with no Westbrook.
Yeah, they're -1 now, which is where it should be. Like, I think they should still be a favorite against the Thunder without Russ. Now, so, you know, this initially, the first place it opened, this number was +320 on the Thunder, and I was getting ready to load up on the Thunder, and then now it's the other way. I think it's too cheap, even without Russ. You know, you look at the offensive rating, which is really, really good this season for the Rockets. It was 112.9. They were, without Russ, but Harden on the floor, 118.7 offensive rating this season, which was 97th percentile out of every lineup that ever played a minute in the NBA this season. I think Harden +4 shooters is actually more deadly than Harden +3 shooters and Russ, even though, you know, they went super small and were kind of catering to him as playing the center role, playing around the rim more often. Their offense is probably going to be better. So I took a position with Houston. I laid the series -150. I have the +2 here in game one. And, you know, if Russ is back in game 2, 3, 4, 5, great. It's fine. I think he's good enough. He's a bonus defensively, and he can hit tough shots, and he's a force in transition, all that stuff. But I think people kind of just forget how good James Harden is just because they play such a gimmicky style of offense, and that the Rockets are just going to outmath the Oklahoma City Thunder, a team that shoots the 29th fewest threes. They shoot a ton of mid-range jumpers. The Rockets don't shoot any mid-range. They shoot the most threes by a big margin. And as great as Chris Paul and Gallinari are relative to the league at making mid-range, those are still only worth 2 points, and the Rockets are making three-pointers with 5 shooters on the floor, essentially. So, too much, and I think Harden will, you know, do his thing, get to the line. You know how the last 2 years – they've matched up against Utah and essentially played Rudy Gobert off the floor, where Utah couldn't even play Gobert. They had to go smaller with Favors at the five or even smaller than that. What's Steven Adams going to do? I'm really intrigued to see because he's a very similar type of defender and guy who wants to be, you know, helping protecting the rim, this and that. But if he's played off the floor, the Thunder are not deep in any regard. You know, before the Utah injuries or kind of living the bubble, I would have said the Thunder were the least deep team in the bubble, period, and of the playoff teams. And so now, you know, it went the other way. But I just think that's a very concerning thing for Oklahoma City is if, you know, the Rockets, the way they play their small ball kind of thwarts the Thunder able to play Steven Adams at center, who are they going to go to? Like, do you play Gallinari at center? Okay, good luck with that. I mean, they don't really have a backup center. Nerlens Noel hasn't even really been playing in the restart. That's a huge question mark for me. And we've just seen it happen now in 2 series where the Rockets and Harden are, you know, basically saying, hey, you can't even play your center on the floor if you want to be able to hang with us.
So you really like the Rockets. And I agree that Harden gets dismissed a lot from some of the memes or whatever, his defense or lack thereof. But he's such an effective scorer. It's crazy. And honestly, Covington's just been so, so perfect for this team. A wingspan over 7 feet. He plays obviously bigger than he is. He's just the perfect guy for this team. And guys like Danwell House and all these guys, they make shots. The whole league is just making shots now. It's crazy. I mean, you see warm-ups. Dwight Howard's making threes. It's insane. But, I mean, if they're going to just stick threes, then there's no way to really defend it.
There isn't. And I will say one argument for Oklahoma City is they're tied for second best in the NBA in opponent three-point percentage. So they're tied with Boston. Only Toronto is better by a few decimal points of a percent. So you would think, oh, well, great. They're great at defending the three, and the Rockets shoot a ton of threes. That's true to some degree, but it's also relative to how you're defending the three. A lot of teams have to double Harden when he starts driving, and then the Rockets are getting open threes. And so can Oklahoma City still defend in a way that they can go one-on-one against Harden without Harden destroying them with Steven Adams, like in switches? And if they can, they have to double, then the Rockets are getting open threes, and you can't really bank on Oklahoma City's three-point defense that has manifested itself over the course of the season, at least not as much. So, it's a really good matchup. I think it probably is. I also bet over 5.5 games. So even though I think the Rockets is cheap, I also have this going 6 or 7 games pretty fairly often, whether Russ comes back or not. So I think both bets are pretty good, and it should be close.
Yeah, those spread series stuff is really fun. So I'm glad I know you mentioned it earlier with the Blazers. But I'm glad you mentioned it again, because it really is an awesome component to all this. It's all you on the Pacers Heat. I really have no feeling whatsoever. I mean, I've heard solid cases on both ends. I just got to watch this series because I like what Indy did. They cashed me a little bit of money against the Lakers. But, I mean, the Pacers, their ability to score, they can just score much more easily than Indiana.
Well, they definitely can. And I think I was – hoping for more of a reaction than we got. I mean, the early openers were like Heat prices were minus 200, like 204, I think was the first one. It's just been slowly climbing. Game one line's been slowly climbing. The thing was this, you know, you had TJ Warren, who was MVP of the entire league for the first 4 or 5 games of the restart in the bubble. Just 7 of 10 from three, like no problem at all. Just crushing teams. And, you know, he gets injured, and it was precautionary. He rested a couple of games down the stretch. So people just remember this Pacers team that was dominating and TJ Warren going off. And here's the thing. They don't have their most impactful guy over the course of the entire season was Sabonis. He's not there anymore. And I know TJ Warren kind of made up for that for a few games. He's not going to shoot 70% from three in a playoff series. And he's definitely not doing it against Jimmy Butler, who of any player in the entire NBA that has defended TJ Warren, he's done it in the best way, in the best rate. TJ Warren's shooting 33% against Jimmy Butler. The next closest guy is at 38%. Now, Warren will probably shoot better than 33% from the field against Jimmy Butler. But the point is, he's not shooting 70% and just going absolutely bonkers over the course of a series. And then it's very similar to this OKC-Houston matchup, in my opinion, with just out-mathing the Pacers. They don't shoot very many threes at all. They don't shoot them at a very good percentage. And now you're going up against a Miami team with, for example, Duncan Robinson, the best shooter in the bubble, and some other guys like Dragic and Hero can at least shoot the three, and you have none, and Iguodala will be in the mix off the bench. Jimmy Butler himself is probably the best player on the floor, period. Anyways, we saw what he was able to do and take Kawhi and the Raptors to 7 games, kind of leading the Sixers. It's too much. So it's the Heat. And I think my true price for that is like minus 360. So there was quite a big of an edge there when it was minus 200s up to like minus 300. I thought it was bettable. Now it's probably a stay away. I think most places are closer to that minus 320 range, which is not as much of an edge. I think it's Miami though, like you said, not much else to say.
Okay. Great. No, I mean, look, that would be the only side I would play, but I like this Pacers team. Oladipo's obviously healthy now, and he looks great at times. So that's what got me concerned. But, yeah, no, I'm glad I was able to pass the buck, so to speak. So in terms of the macro, you know, we've talked about the futures of the Clippers on the Western Conference and even plus 325 to win it all. But the thing we haven't talked about in this pod is just like the East. We touched on the Bucks being overrated, and they're still losing, by the way. But what about this, you know, the Celtics have come down a little bit, as are the Raptors. Are you buying the Raptors as a legit, contender?
They definitely kind of always were. I had, you know, Philly and Boston rated slightly ahead of them anyways, entering the setup, this, or the restart, I should say. And the injury to Ben Simmons kind of puts Philly out of the mix some. And then the injury to Gordon Hayward, who's grade 3 ankle sprain, announced today, out at least 4 weeks. This second round matchup against Toronto and Boston, like, that's a big deal not having Hayward now. It means a lot more Semi Ojeleye minutes and Wanamaker. It means, you know, Marcus Smart is going to have to start probably. So then your backup point guard is Wanamaker a lot more often. Maybe Kemba's minutes has to go up. I know he's, you know, been on restriction. The whole thing is just too bad. And because I had actually finally jumped in and was buying the Celtics at, you know, +554, I think was my average price I got on that bet to win the East. And, you know, I thought they matched up really good against Toronto. We saw it a few weeks ago in that matchup in the bubble game they played. And it's ultimately, you know, which teams can take advantage of the fact that Daniel Theis and Enes Kanter just aren't going to be guys that can rim protect. And Giannis probably could, and Embiid probably could, although they actually did a great job in game one anyways, limiting that. And so then you go to the next team. It's like, okay, Toronto, well, Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka are out setting screens on the three-point line and shooting jumpers. They're not really guys that are going to attack Boston's weakness. Siakam maybe could. He's had that ability. He's not as big or as forceful as Giannis or Embiid would be. He's also, he really fell off in the playoffs last year. I'm curious to see how he performs in general. We've seen until last year, you know, Lowry was struggling every game they would try to play against the Cavs with DeMar DeRozan. Lowry in last year was great, but Kawhi Leonard was really the guy that in high leverage, half court possessions, when you just need a bucket, like, you were just giving it to Kawhi and he was getting it, or Fred VanVleet turned into Steph Curry for two series, which will not happen again. He literally scored 12 points total in the series prior to the Bucks one. And then everyone remembers him in those two series of the Eastern Conference Finals and the Finals just going off. And it's just, you can't expect that again either. So you have no Kawhi, no Danny Green either, but, you know, other guys have stepped up like OG Anunoby and Terrence Davis was great as a rookie. But if FEV is not shooting 57% from three and you don't have Kawhi Leonard to rely on, that worries me about Toronto. So I'm like, all right, well, Simmons is out. I still can't fully buy Toronto. And now Hayward's out for Boston, which really hurts them. Maybe it is just the Bucks. It's just going to happen. And then now they're down double digits in the fourth quarter in game one to the Magic. So who knows, man? If you have, maybe it's the Heat. I don't even know anymore. If you have a sneaky pick, I'd love to hear it. But I can't figure this Eastern Conference out anymore.
Well, I definitely, you know, I know the odds are -175, but I would take the field against the Bucks for the East. I really do thought there's vulnerability, and I don't think people realize, like, maybe they do, but like the refs are swayed by the home crowd. The travel takes a lot out of you, and just the comfort of your home games, not just the crowd. It's just the not having to travel is a big factor, at least when I'm trying to identify with a player. So I just think this neutral court thing really levels the playing field in a sport that's obviously the most predictable of all the major sports. So, I mean, they're down double digits here. I do think the Heat have – so I thought all those – I thought the top six teams, right? I thought the Sixers – now, without Ben Simmons is a different story. But I thought the Sixers and Heat going in were definitely having a puncher's chance. And I – because you remember, you don't have to beat every other team, right? You just have to beat the teams in front of you. And that's why I still like the Celtics. It depends how long Hayward is out. Do we know for official yet?
Gordon Hayward?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's grade 3 out at least 4 weeks. It's, like, really bad.
He's wow, out, I missed, like, that.
Yeah, almost certainly for the second round, yeah.
Oh, now I'm seeing the headline on ESPN. Okay, well, I had to write a newser.
It's rough.
That is really bad. Yeah, I know you – so I didn't realize that was that severe. I just thought it was speculation, and we'll know. So, and they get in the second round Raptors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most likely, yeah.
That's big. Brad Stevens will pull someone out of nowhere. Like, you know, one of those guys like Grant Williams might have a monster series or a couple games or something just ridiculous.
True.
But I have to see how they look against Philly, but I still like the Celtics in game two. But yeah, no, it's interesting. And then the Lakers, like I told you about a month ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, that I was very confident the Lakers or Clippers would prevail in the West. I just felt really confident. Now I don't because of the Lakers' vulnerability. I just don't see how the Clippers lose 4 out of 7. I mean, Kawhi's amazing. We know that. But even Paul George, I think he's a little underrated.
He's so good at just making shots. Yeah.
He just makes threes in the biggest – and he's defensively, he's excellent. And then at the rim – when he attacks and contorts his body. So if Beverly's going to hit some threes like he did in the second half, not the first half, and they have guys like Morris going off. And if you're going to put Zubac in the pick and roll, and then you can, you know, go small, I just don't see how they lose. Kawhi's that good. And so is everyone else.
And you didn't even mention either of the six men of the year, assuming Harrell wins it this year, and Lou Williams, who's won it for a few years. Like, they're just stacked. And that's the biggest difference, is that three through X, like three through, say, nine, your main rotation of nine guys, they're just so much better than the Lakers.
Yeah, it's disappointing because I really love that, you know, LeBron having a guy like AD, right? He's had Dwayne Wade, he's had Kyrie, and to get a guy like AD, he finally feels like he can compete. But then the Clippers last summer obviously threw him a curveball, and Kawhi doesn't get Paul George, and look what happens. So should be awesome, and we're obviously going to do more content. We have some more Daily Wager content announcements coming up, but I at least want to do this pseudo playoff preview, because now the Bucks are down two touchdowns here with 6 minutes to go. Remarkable. Remarkable. And I like the over. I said the over on SportsCenter. I got some work to do. I got 22 points to go at 520. So
you should get there.
Should get there with the Bucks being down, but you never know if Orlando starts to bleed clock. Okay, bud. Well, thank you so much for the insight. I know our listeners were demanding it on Twitter, so we had to do an emergency pod, so to speak.
Yep, absolutely.
Time now to bring in another friend of the program. Wes Reynolds does a great job with our golf the last, I'd say, 2 months or so. And Wes, we talked about it last week. A triple-digit guy always wins this tournament. We just didn't have the right guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim Herman, look, he doesn't go well all that often, but when he does, he usually wins. I think he has, I saw two top 25 finishes in the last 2 years, and both of those top 25 finishes were wins. So imagine that. Jim Herman's got three PGA Tour wins, and you got some top 15 to 20 players that are still looking for their first PGA Tour win.
So let's talk about this. It's the Northern Trust, like I said, in the Boston area. It's all about the FedEx Cup playoffs get going right now. The top 70 in points will advance to the BMW Championship next weekend. They're all vying for a $15 million prize. So obviously that is a dangled carrot, to say the least. I want to start with Tiger Woods, though. 49th in the official standings. When we talked about it, we faded him in the PGA Championship in some matchups that proved to be profitable. I guess, you know, in order for him to pull it off, he needs to play in three consecutive tournaments and do well. Is he physically able to do that in your estimation?
I think he is. I mean, he's certainly well-rested. He doesn't have a lot of reps. He's only played two tournaments since the restart, that being the Memorial and, of course, the PGA a couple weeks ago. But Tiger is somebody I'm definitely wanting to look closely at, because I've been kind of maybe starting to dig him a little bit, perhaps, for the U.S. Open. I know for majors, everybody points to the Masters because that's the one where he's had the most success, and that's the one where he's most likely to win, probably, of the four at this stage of his career. But in terms of the U.S. Open, I want to see how he plays in these events. And if you see something, some signs of life, because like that fourth round at the PGA, he started to finally make some putts and shot a really solid round on Sunday. And, you know, could have went out there and just went through the motions, tried to get it done as fast as he can, get on the plane, go back home. But he really grinded it out. He's the greatest grinder in the history of the game of golf. So I want to see how he plays these next couple weeks, because the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, the U.S. Open pretty much every single time, no matter where it's held, is a grind. And nobody grinds better than he does. And I think he's a guy that he's not at the top of the distance charts anymore, but he can still get it out there when he wants to. And I think he would know how to attack a course like Wingfoot that's going to play a lot harder, where it kind of isn't going to be a birdie fest, and that I think falls right into his hands. But I need to see a little bit of something over these next couple of events for him.
Last time he played three straight events, in terms of three straight weeks I should say, was a similar stretch on the calendar for 2018. So it's been a couple years, but he said he's played this tournament 10 times, which is the second most he's played any stop on the tour without winning it. So maybe he's due, or maybe he just doesn't jive well with him. So I'm with you, though. I'm keeping an eye on Tiger. I think he's definitely fadeable at times, and that's the only time it's the only way I would play him right now. But maybe down the road, like you said, U.S. Open or even the Masters, we shall see. Now let's talk about this tournament specifically, obviously got the big names involved. Who are some guys at the top of the leaderboard that you think that you still find value despite the relatively short odds?
Yeah, because you can make a case really for all of them. The last two winners, because this is the Northern Trust, which is usually played in the New York, New Jersey area, but now it's going to rotate back and forth with Boston. The Deutsche Bank Championship, and then later known as the Dell Technologies Championship, was held on this course at TPC Boston from 2003 to 2018. And you look at who the last two winners are at TPC Boston, that would be Bryson DeChambeau and Justin Thomas. They are the favorites this week at 12-1, rightfully so. And then you have John Rahm, number one in the world, him and Rory McIlroy, who is a two-time winner here at TPC Boston. And you know, maybe this is the week Rory goes on and wins. I think he's going to win here soon at some point. But at that price and with his form, I took a pass and I said, you know what? If he's going to beat me, he's going to beat me. So I went just a little bit below that. And of the short odd guys, I would, you know, 20-1 or lower. I landed on Dustin Johnson because he's probably a little bit more under the radar from that top four. And look, he played well enough to win the PGA, but sure, ends up settling for another runner-up. I mean, Colin Morikawa shot 129 on the weekend, 11 under in a major to beat him. So if DJ really didn't do anything wrong, he just got beat. And that happens. The putter was on point. He was tied for fifth in the field in strokes gained putting. He gets on the bent grass, which is his more preferred surface to the Bermuda, even though he's won on both numerous occasions. But he just needs to improve a little on that tee to green game, because the putter had been working. And I think he is the ignored guy. He's a two-time winner of the Northern Trust event, including a 2011 win at Plainfield Country Club in New Jersey. And that is a Gil Hance redesign, which TPC Boston is as well, even though Arnold Palmer was the original designer. But if you're looking for course correlation, you probably want to look at the Gil Hance redesigns and Plainfield Country Club, which has hosted the Barclays, now known as the Northern Trust, Ridgewood Country Club, another Hance design, and then Trump National Doral down in Miami, where they played the Cadillac Championship 2014 to 2016. DJ won on that course in Doral, and he also won at Plainfield. And he's never won here at TPC Boston, but he's had a few top 10 finishes. So he's a guy that, of the short price guys, that I'm going to lean on this week.
You mentioned his name. A guy who I've circled is the guy who won the PGA Championship, Colin Morikawa. Now, I know the par four that he drove was the difference maker, and obviously, as great of a shot as it is, it's not like he dominated, but he has the game. Everyone says he has the game. He's right there, and he's getting 20-1. So why does everyone bet Xander Schauffele, who I maintain has trouble with the putter in big moments, and other guys like DJ, to your point, 16-1, when Morikawa's right in front of us and just delivered?
Yeah, I was a little curious to see that move on Xander, who I'm a fan of, but I didn't use this week. In terms of Morikawa, I think maybe folks are going to be banking on a little bit of a putting regression, because let's not forget, he was 164th in strokes gained putting, and he was first at the PGA. You know, it's not, you have to be a great putter, you just have to putt great sometimes in the majors. But look, the ball striking's obviously off the charts. He ranks near the top in all the tee to green, strokes gained approach, proximity, whatever you want to look at. And he's been getting a little bit better off the tee because he's starting to hit those fades, and he's really liking those shots. They've been working for him. And then he's really good with a par five scoring average, which the par fours are pretty gettable on this course. Par fives are a little bit more difficult, so you don't have a lot of opportunities, and you got to take advantage of them. It's not just, you know, driver, wedge, mark two putt, mark it down to four and move on. These are a little bit more difficult, and he takes advantage of those. So look, I'm not mad at the Morikawa thing. I do think that I need it to be proven that he's made gains with his putter, and that he didn't get hot for 2 days.
That's totally fair. Well defended on that part. Let's go to the next tier of guys. I've circled Patrick Cantlay. I mean, I think he's made the cut in like 18 straight events or something like that. You know, he's just been so solid. Tied for eighth at this event 2 years ago. And, you know, it's hard not to like what he's done. You can get 3-1 on a top 10 prop. So I'm thinking that might be a prop I have circled. I don't think I like him to win it, though.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. And I'm probably going to end up mixing a couple of props than I usually do on some of these guys, some top 10s, some top 20s, where I don't bet full amounts on futures. So I could see Cantlay. It was a little bit of a disappointment at the PGA, but I don't think you necessarily give him too much of a demerit for that, considering one guy that I'll mention later that kind of fits into that category. But the next guy I looked at, Doug, actually, and I said it the day of the PGA because there's a friend of mine that is also a very good golf handicapper and a golf bettor, and it's like, what's going to happen is Jason Day is going to get close and he's going to win something at like 25-1 instead of the 50 and 60-1s that we've been getting on him. And I said, Northern Trust, lock it up, kind of joking. But then I went ahead and played it for this week, Jason Day, because he looks like he's about right there where he's finding his best form in 3 years, where he was a top 5 to 10 player in the world. He's got 4 straight finishes, a 7th or better. He was fourth at the PGA, of course, a couple weeks ago, and was 2nd in greens and regulation, 1st in strokes gained approach for that week out at Harding Park. And I think if you look at the recent form, he really hasn't putted that great. And the short game is Jason Day's bread and butter. When his short game's on, it's one of the best in the world. But he was 39th in strokes gained putting at the St. Jude in Memphis. And then he was 26th in strokes gained putting at the PGA. That was about the upper third of the field. But a third of the field ended up being better in putting. And that probably is what ended up preventing him from winning. But I like Day. I think he fits that Gil-Kantz course correlation angle that I mentioned earlier. He won at Plainfield Country Club back in 2015, this Northern Trust event, then known as the Barclays. He's got 3 finishes of 7th or better on this track at TPC Boston. So he's usually a guy, if you look at his history, he fires really well early on in the FedEx Cup. He's got numerous top 5 finishes and wins. So Jason Day was another of that middle guy. And then I got to go back to my social media for my next guy, because I kind of joked, and a lot of golf Twitter joked last week, as Jim Herman was winning his 3rd PGA Tour event at over 1,000-1, like you were saying, at Circus Sports in Las Vegas. And I was like, must remember that Jim Herman has won 3 PGA Tour events next time I submit on Tony Finau. And what do? I go ahead and submit on Tony Finau, because it's like, now that I've joked about him and we all kind of crapped on him, you know, in a joking manner, of course, not personally negative, but now is when he's probably going to break through and shut us all the hell up. And I can totally see that with Finau. Look, he's got a 4th on this course back in 2018. And then also he's got some other good history in some FedEx Cup playoff events. He was 2nd to Bryson last year at Ridgewood, or actually 2 years ago at Ridgewood for the Northern Trust in 2018. The week before, he got the 4th on this course at the old Dell Technologies Championship. But look, he is a guy, I think this course will fit him because we know he can bomb it out there. He was 2nd in strokes gained approach at the PGA. He was 3rd in strokes to gain tee to green. And if he can just carry those marks over this week, he should be right there in contention. The issue is obviously not him getting in contention, because he peppers leaderboards. He's always there, it seems like. But if he can kick in the door late on Sunday, eventually it's going to happen. But we're having to spend some money to find out, unfortunately.
I know. And I took the bait recently with Finau on this very podcast. Quick question for you. With guards with Finau who just can't close, that's the narrative, right? Do his prop payouts, like top 10, top 20, are they correlated to his futures, or are they like lowered and there's, you know, do you understand what I'm trying to ask?
Right.
Do they skew the top 10 and 20 payouts that, so it's not exactly correlated to his futures because he's always in the money but never cashing?
I think that for the most part, I mean, maybe a couple shops will shade him a little bit downwards and give you lower odds than you should. But I think for the most part, they stay pretty correlated on Finau. I mean, the fact that you're getting them at 40-1, because if you look at the results and you look at where he's ranked in the world rankings, he's number 15 in the world. So that would show that you're just right below the elite of the elite in the golf world. But the fact that you could still get him at these events at in the 40, between 40 and 50 to one range on the futures, and then correspond that with the props. I think the prop markets are still pretty fair on this guy, despite the fact that I believe the PGA was his 31st top 10 finish since the 2016-17 season where he last won at the Puerto Rico Open.
Just remarkable. All right, we're a little tight on time here, Wes. Why don't you just fire away your last few guys?
Okay, real quick. Adam Scott, 50-1. It was just a speculative market play. Look, he's had one event since the restart, the PGA. But the last time he was in that situation was earlier in February. Last December, he won over in Australia, the Australian PGA Championship. Didn't play an event for 2.5 months. Then he goes to a course where he had success before, like Riviera, and what's he do? He goes ahead and wins. He was the winner of the first event. Actually, his first PGA Tour event was on this course, TPC Boston, 2003, and won here. So I think Adam Scott, you're getting a decent price. I think people are scared of the rust factor, but I think he's shown he can get over that. And then two quick 60-1 guys, Abraham Answer, who was the 54-hole leader here at TPC Boston 2 years ago before he slipped and finished and tied for seventh. He was also second in the Northern Trust last year at Liberty National to Patrick Reed. Had three runner-up finishes in the last year. He's number 25 in the world, and probably a lot of casual fans have never heard of the guy, because he has worldwide wins, but not a PGA Tour win. But he's got the all-around game here. And then last guy I'm going to do is I'm going to buy on the drift with Matt Fitzpatrick at 60-1. A lot of people liked him as a sneaky play for the PGA, and I took a pass on him because at Memphis the week before, he gained 10 strokes over 4 days putting and only finished 9 under par. So I thought, even a putter like Fitzpatrick, who's second on the tour in strokes gained putting, even a guy like that is going to regress. So then he misses the cut at the PGA, and he was priced at some places in the high 30s, low 40s. Now he's back to the 60s, where he probably should be. So buy on the drift with this guy. I think this guy is going to win within the next month or two. And now people kind of forget about him, and I think overrate that missed cut at the PGA.
So the recency bias giving us an advantage in the futures market, where he's, instead of being just depressed odds. All right, man, I'll find a triple digit. I'll probably have to post about it on .com. I don't have one right now at the time of our taping. We're doing this a little earlier than we normally do, so I apologize for the listeners. I'm actually moving this week, so preoccupied with that. But I'll have some stuff for .com, maybe tweet it out as well. But a lot of insight. All tickets cash the same, so it's not just about the PGA and the majors, but this is a big one. Patrick Reed is the defending champ. It's like never happened, basically, in the FedEx Cup playoffs on the same event. So I'm steered away from him, although his odds were tempting. So that's all we got. Those are six good guys out of US. I appreciate it very much.
All right, you got it, Doug. Thanks for having me as always, man.
Kicking is for losers.
Thanks to Wes, and of course, thanks to Preston Johnson as well. Fun pod, a little bit longer given the NBA playoff preview or pseudo preview, but a lot of fun there. Wes does a great job, as you guys very well know. Not on a lot of guys this week, maybe taking a week off too. So thanks to everyone for downloading and listening and rating and reviewing. Again, I mentioned it earlier with Preston, we're going to have some interesting announcements coming up in a matter of days for Daily Wager, and a big change for ESPN.com's chalk section along those lines. So the crew, if you will, in Daily Wager. So stay tuned for that, and we'll catch you back here on the podcast next week.